For the week of September 16th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 163, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, exhausted but happy, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, why are you so exhausted?
Oh, my weekend. Well, what did you do this weekend, Sperling?
Well, I played this very important role, it's one that many actors would like to play. It's called Father, actually. I was a parent.
And did you have a satisfying time with the kids? Did you take them to a movie or did you just batten down the hatches and try to survive?
I locked them in the closet and slid bread and water under the door.
Oh, so it's sort of a Joan Crawford thing.
Yes. No more wire hangers. What did you wind up doing?
It's a typical New York weekend. Friday, I went to a Yankee game. Saturday morning, my friends picked me up and I went to a food fair down in Brooklyn in Williamsburg, kind of a hipster section, and watched a dumpling eating contest. Then I went to an off-Broadway play starring David Schwimmer and Amy Ryan. Then I met friends for barbecue. Then I went to the five-hour opera Einstein on the Beach at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Then Sunday, I went to see another play. Which one was that? Oh, that was at the Signature Theater Company, a new play by Sam Shepard. Then I went to Mass, and then I topped it off by seeing The Master in 70mm on the Upper West Side.
Wow. You know what? Hold on. I'm just going to take a quick nap before we begin, after hearing all of that.
That's why I'm late getting online.
Okay, well, our news this week may not be as eventful, but on today's show, we're going to be speaking with Ann Thompson, editor of the Thompson on Hollywood blog over on IndieWire. She's just back from both the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals, so as Ann's eyes get readjusted to the light, we plan on getting the scoop on the fall festival season. Not to mention a jump on the awards season, because she has an opinion about that as well. Meanwhile, Tom Rothman, head of 20th Century Fox, or former head of 20th Century Fox, he surprised the industry last week by announcing he would be stepping down after 18 years at the studio. We'll bring you up to speed on that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire, or should I say, the master, Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie at the box office around the world is the same as the number one movie in North America. It's Resident Evil Retribution, the fifth in the series. It grossed $71 million worldwide, which sounds a lot more impressive than the, what was it, $19, $21 million? The $21 million that it grossed in North America. This series is a much bigger film overseas. Sometimes it's grossing 3 to 4 times as much as its U.S. box office. So this is a really big series, and focusing on the worldwide box office lets you see that, because now we know, instead of saying $21 million, $71 million is some serious money, especially for a film series that isn't that expensive to make.
And you know what? Just a side note here. There's 5 of these films at this point. I have seen precisely none of them.
Well, this one cost $65 million to make. It grossed more than its budget in opening weekend. That's always a good sign.
I don't know why, but I have like no interest in seeing these movies. I have no idea why.
Maybe if you moved overseas, you would.
Maybe.
At number 2 around the world is the Pixar film Finding Nemo, presented in 3D. It grossed $19 million. It's now at $890 million worldwide, including, obviously, its previous run. If they can make another $110 million, it could join Toy Story 3 in the billion-dollar club. Prior to that, it was the highest-grossing Pixar film of all time. But it's good to see it back in theaters, 3D, you know what we think. Number 3 is The Bourne Legacy, the attempted reboot of the franchise. That's at $12 million, and it's made $200 million worldwide and counting.
I would say that we can officially say that film was a disappointment financially.
Yes.
Okay.
Assuming we're not surprised by any more territories that it hasn't opened up in yet.
Yes.
And number 4 around the world is The Expendables 2, another $9 million. It's at $185 million and counting. But as with last week, these are very rough figures. A lot of the numbers haven't come in. This feels like a very old school movie release where every territory is handled by a local company. They sold it off piecemeal. And in fact, I'm glad I'm not the producer on this movie, because I feel like all the money that it's making around the world is disappearing into a black hole. You're going to want the accountants in on this one, because numbers are coming in very late. They're going to say, you made $8 last week in Malaysia? Really? Just $8? Yeah, what can we say? So I feel like this movie is probably making more money than we can figure out. And I imagine the producer will be right on top of that.
Well, that's a Lionsgate film, and that's kind of the way Lionsgate releases their films. You know, they take domestic, and by domestic, I mean North America, and they sometimes take some overseas territories. But the way they finance their movies is by selling off the territories. So, of course, that's exactly what I would expect out of something like that.
it's been a while since I've seen so many caveats about the box office for a movie, though. You know, it's, we follow worldwide boxes all the time. This movie in particular, they keep saying, yeah, we really don't know what it made. Literally, what I did to get the worldwide box office was assume it fell by 50% from last weekend. I just cut last weekend's overseas gross in half because there are no figures available. So that's a very rough estimate. Tied at number five is Ted and The Dark Knight Rises. Both movies made $8 million. Both, of course, are huge success stories. Ted is now over $400 million. And Dark Knight Rises, of course, is in the billion-dollar club. Tied at number six are three different films, which grossed $7 million. Paranorman, the animated film. I should say stop-motion animated. Prometheus, the Ridley Scott movie. And Madagascar 3. Paranorman is doing pretty good. It's at $75 million worldwide. Prometheus is getting closer and closer to $400 million. And Madagascar 3 is at $620 million and counting. At number 10 is the horror film Possession. It made another $6 million. It's at $41 million and counting, basically in North America. At number 11 is Lawless, the Shia LaBeouf movie. It made $5 million. It's at $31 million and counting. It just opened in one territory overseas. At number 12 and 13 are two pretty big flops, The Watch, the Ben Stiller comedy, and Total Recall. They both made $4 million overseas. The Watch is at a very sad $53 million worldwide and counting. Total Recall is still trying to get to $200 million. It's at $171. And number 14, finally, is another flop. I shouldn't say that. Another movie that is doing very modestly at the box office, The Words, starring Bradley Cooper. I sort of made fun of him and teased him, saying he's still trying to prove that he's not a box office star because other than The Hangover, he hasn't really been the force behind the movie. It made $3 million worldwide. It's at $9 million and counting for a movie that didn't cost very much to make. However, Bradley Cooper had great news, as we heard from Toronto, with Silver Linings Playbook, and I'm sure Ann Thompson will be talking about his film as a potential Oscar nominee.
Yes, well, I'm glad that Bradley Cooper called you to set his reputation straight.
He's like, dude, what are you doing to me?
Yeah, you know.
And I said, dude. Well, I didn't really. But in limited release notice, I helped The Master, obviously, the Paul Thomas Anderson film starring Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, grossed an astonishing $146,000 per screen. It was at five locations. Obviously, in each location, it could be on multiple screens. I saw it in Lincoln Square. It was playing in 70 millimeter and digital. I saw it in 70 millimeter, the way everyone should if they have even a remote possibility of doing so. It's a very interesting Stanley Kubrickian film, but a very promising start. Given the type of film it is, I can't imagine it would translate into a massive box office hit down the road. I think like There Will Be Blood, its prospects are modest, but it is a very interesting film. And if you're a film buff, you absolutely have to see it.
And seeing it in 70 millimeter is going to be tough. I mean, there aren't too many theaters in the world that can play 70 millimeter anymore.
That's true.
Yeah, but he did shoot it in 65 millimeter, which of course turns into 70 millimeter when you add the soundtrack. So it's kind of like, the way David Lean shot Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago, you know, it's that 1960s big frame format.
That's right. And one more box office note, I would say that this weekend, 2016.
Oh, my God. You with this 2016. But go ahead.
It grossed $2 million this weekend.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it is kind of astounding, or not astounding, but amazing. Well, maybe astounding and amazing that it keeps making so much money.
If it had grossed $2 million in its entire run, it would rank in the top 150 documentary films of all time. I'm sorry, 150 documentaries of any sort of all time. That is a lot of money for a documentary film to make. It's 10 weeks into its run. It's grossed $30 million overall. It continues to do extraordinary business at the box office.
Well, now, two things. One, just to go back to The Master for a second, Amy Adams is also in that. And the only reason I bring it up is we'll probably be talking about that with Ann Thompson because everybody's talking about Amy Adams for an Oscar nomination for her portrayal in that film.
Or for the Eastwood movie.
Or for the Clint Eastwood movie, correct. Trouble with the Curve. Is that the name of the film, Trouble with the Curve?
She plays the daughter of Clint. It seems much less likely of an Oscar contender, at least for her. If anybody would get one, it's probably Clint. So I think her role in The Master is probably more likely to be the sort that would give her an Oscar nomination. We'll have to see.
Well, and I think, quite frankly, that Clint does a much better job acting opposite Amy Adams than he did acting opposite an empty chair. frankly. In regards to 2016 Obama's America, you might recall when Fahrenheit 9/11 was released in 2004, it went on to make $100 million, and everybody said, oh my goodness, this is, you know, a telltale sign for how the election will go in 2004. It looks like Bush is done. Well, if the same thing holds here, if Obama winds up being reelected, I guess you can say, hey, don't make a documentary that is against me if I'm a sitting president, because...
What do you mean? They made a lot of money. It's a huge success story.
No, what I mean is, if you're a politician, then you're running against an incumbent. You wouldn't want a documentary made against the incumbent. Well, never mind. You know what
I mean. I see it. It was seen as a predictor, but yeah, he won re-election. Yes.
Right, exactly. I was not explaining myself very well.
Well, hopefully Ann Thompson will explain herself better when she talks about the film she saw at Telluride in Toronto.
Well, yes, Michael, I certainly hope so, because every year, come September, the movie business enters what is known as the fall film festival season. You know, I'm kind of sure that in the southern hemisphere of planet Earth, this is known as the spring film festival season. But anyway, between Venice and in Italy, there's Telluride in the U.S. and Toronto in Canada, and not to mention the upcoming New York Film Festival, movie stars, filmmakers, they can rack up a ton of frequent flyer miles attending all of these events. But what these festivals are also known for is kicking off the awards season leading up to the Oscars. Here to tell us about this year's festivities is Ann Thompson, the editor of Thompson on Hollywood over on IndieWire, also the host of Oscar Talk, and that can be found on iTunes. I don't know where else it can be found, maybe In Contention. She is just back from both Telluride and Toronto. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So you went to Telluride first, and that's over Labor Day weekend, so the first weekend in September here in the United States. What was that like this year?
Well, Ben Affleck's Argo was sort of the big pop out of there. It was fun to see him and Jennifer up there. I think they're even considering buying a house in Telluride. She had shown Butter there the year before, so they fell in love with this festival where people get to run around and hang out and not worry about doing interviews. So he was the big pop, first of all. The other, Amour played there as well. It had broken in Cannes and won the Palme d'Or, but you could see that that was playing really well for the audience there in Telluride. So that came out ahead as well.
Now, Amour is the film by Michael Haneke about two elderly couple, I guess is how I would describe that, one of whom becomes very ill and is slowly dying, and how the husband takes care of her.
Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva, both beautifully portrayed. And I think what we're learning is that they may end up being, you know, the kind of performances that the Academy will respond to at the end of the day.
Now, Argo is Ben Affleck's film. He directed the film, and it's about the Iranian hostage situation in 1980. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's set in Tehran, and he plays a CIA agent, and it's all based on a true story. There was a kind of a counter story put out at the time about the Canadians and how they helped to save these six people who escaped from the hostage situation or were being sort of hidden in various embassies, including the Canadian one. But it turns out that there was this CIA guy who masterminded this outrageous plot to create a fake movie. And so suddenly in the middle of this very serious, intense sort of insider, like more sort of like a Michael Mann movie, like The Insider, suddenly you're you know, watching a Hollywood parody. And John Goodman and Alan Arkin are hilarious as the producers of this fake movie that are going to try to get these people out of Tehran.
Now, Argo was in Toronto as well. Was it in Venice?
No.
Okay,
but it did very well in Toronto as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we talked about Amour, which, as you say, premiered in Cannes and won the Palme d'Or there. It's now in Telluride. But a lot of these films, especially ones that are premiering over the last 2 weeks, they kind of appear in more than one festival. So Black Swan will appear at Telluride and Venice, and I believe it was also in Toronto. And Argo will appear in Telluride and Toronto. The Master, was at Telluride, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I am mistaken. They did not play Telluride. There was some debate as to why they wanted to play The Master, but apparently it was a combination of the fact that it played in all these other cities. Paul Thomas Anderson is sort of masterminding this bizarre sort of unusually innovative way of presenting the movie around the country. And the people at Telluride weren't thrilled by that. But they also didn't get Anderson to come. And finally, it probably amounts to the fact that Anderson didn't want it to be there one way or the other.
That'll do it. What is his unique release pattern? I'm not familiar with this.
It played in Chicago, New York. It played in all these different LA, all these different cities. I think something like seven major cities long before its release and long before it supposedly debuted in Toronto.
Okay, it played in Venice as well, I see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why is it?
But not Telluride.
But not Telluride. So why is it that?
But everybody reviewed it already. By the time, I mean, supposedly these festivals are debuting something, premiering something, giving it a world premiere. It doesn't count if it's already shown in all these big 70mm theaters in all these major cities where reviewers reviewed it.
Well, you've been at all these festivals. This year, I've had to sit out a lot of them for financial reasons. I'm trying to launch a business, and it's expensive to go, and there's just far less freelancing work available. I'm wondering what the state of the industry is like as far as the journalists attending, the people going, how vibrant it is. Do Toronto and Telluride and all those, do they feel like there's a new wave of journalists, bloggers, and online people, or are you not seeing the same people coming back, or what's happening?
A lot of the newspapers, the big newspapers, are not sending as many people to the festivals as they used to, especially Cannes. I would say Cannes is the one that's really taken a hit, but because it's so expensive. Telluride is also an expensive festival, but a lot of people go on their own dime just for a weekend, just for a vacation. I mean, Beth Hanna, who writes for me and is certainly not making a fortune in this world, and I didn't send her, she and her boyfriend went to Telluride just for the weekend to have a wonderful time. That was their vacation.
You know, I almost went this year myself just for a vacation because, you know, there are no press passes at Telluride. Telluride is a small, I guess you could call it a ski town, but it's a mountain resort town in Colorado. It's not easy to get to. The theaters are separated at times by a gondola, which is a lovely ride. It's absolutely beautiful and gorgeous. It's a great festival because it's just so relaxed and laid back. But you're right, because it's so remote, it's very expensive to get to it. And that's why I was just going to go just for my own kind of pleasure, really.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, basically you see families going back year after year, you see people from all over the country, and it's actually a very good bellwether of how movies will play with smart art house audiences. And one of the movies that I thought took a little bit of a hit in Telluride, just in terms of revealing its weakness as a crowd pleaser, was something like Rust and Bone, which I admire so much, Jacques Audiard's film with Marion Cotillard. But it is not, it's a tough movie, and people didn't necessarily embrace it.
And of course, this was the film that premiered in Cannes of this year.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and didn't win anything.
Yes.
I might add. So, I mean, Sony Pictures Classics had five movies in Telluride, and they're, of course, looking to, you know, push Marion Cotillard, who had a tribute in Telluride, for Best Actress. She's won before, and she's in the club, but we'll see what happens. The other film that broke out in both Telluride and Toronto was The Gatekeepers, which is an extraordinary Israeli documentary featuring first ever in-depth interviews with the top heads of Shin Bet over the years. Imagine a movie where you're interviewing the heads of the CIA, you know, candidly, and they're dissing the politicians, and they're all sounding like liberals. They're all saying that Israel should get the hell out of Palestine. It was unbelievable.
Well, that must have been very interesting given the events over the past week with the Muslim world kind of blowing up over a film that denigrates Islam. Was that talked about at all during the festival?
That was in Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto.
That's
sorry.
That's when it happened. Yeah. In Telluride, I mean, that also served to show how timely Argo really is, because Argo literally at the beginning of the movie shows a mob attacking the embassy. This is 1980. And now in 2012, that movie turns out to be altogether too writing. This, you know, very zeitgeisty right now.
Well, we link to your coverage in our show notes. And one of the big stories we link to is the Oscar predictions 2013, because you are an expert on the Oscars. And you list six films as current frontrunners for Best Picture. and I wanted to talk about them. And I imagine some of the films that made the second level that are contenders are movies like Lincoln and Zero Dark 30 and Life of Pi and Les Mis, which we haven't really seen yet. So most people don't have a sense.
I do that because I refuse to put a movie that I haven't seen in the front runner list. I'm a little bit idiosyncratic in this way.
You're old school.
Yes. That's right. Because you really can't tell until you've seen it. You really can't.
Exactly.
No matter what, how many elements are there, no matter if it's, you know, Steven Spielberg and Daniel Day-Lewis, of course we know that that's going to be in the running. But until you see it, you don't know.
Right. I guess a lot of people last year would have thought War Horse was a contender, and in the end, it wasn't.
Well, it got a lot of nominations.
True.
Not as many as people expected.
Right. No, I thought it was a terrible movie, but but if it gets nominations, it gets nominations. My big question about your frontrunner is Anna Karenina. I agree with Argo and The Master and Moonrise Kingdom and The Sessions, though I think that's more likely for just acting nods, and The Silver Linings Playbook. But I'm wondering about Anna Karenina, since the buzz I get, and I haven't seen it, is that it got some play at reviews. People felt it was bold and daring stylistically, but it didn't quite work critically, and it certainly doesn't sound like if it didn't work critically, it's going to turn into a crowd pleaser because of the kind of heightened theatricality that the movie embraces.
Okay. I'm going for Anna Karenina for a different reason, which is that the Academy, and remember, we're talking about the Academy here. We're not talking about the critics, and we're not talking about, you know, it helps if it's a hit. It helps if it gets good reviews. But what the Academy really appreciates is the kind of craft that is on display here. This is costumes, art direction, cinematography, score. This movie is gorgeous. It's beautifully mounted. Joe Wright is a very, very talented director. If we have 10, I mean, we don't know how many movies are going to wind up in the top list. It could be 6. It could be 8. It could be 9 or 10. But if we have a long list, Anna Karenina might wind up there because of what I'm saying. Also, Keira Knightley's very good. In a weak Best Actress field, she could come through. And Jude Law may very well come through as a supporting actor contender. I'm curious to see what the final reviews on this are, because around my, you know, just anecdotally, in terms of what I heard around me at Toronto, people liked the movie. They almost felt, I don't know quite how to describe this. It was almost as though they were embarrassed to admit how much they liked the movie. And I'm not sure why that is the case.
Maybe they would sound too pompous if they said they liked it. I don't know.
It's Tolstoy. It's Tolstoy. And that story is a great classic story. And it comes through loud and clear. And I think that the Tom Stoppard wrote the screenplay. As Variety would say, all the production values were top notch.
Well, The Sessions was a big Sundance film and stars, oh my goodness, I'm going to...
John Hawks.
Thank you.
And Helen Hunt.
Yes, and in what could be career-worthy performances, and he plays somebody who's in an iron lung who wants to lose his virginity, and Helen Hunt helps him do that. But The Silver Linings Playbook got a lot of buzz coming out of Toronto. It won the Audience Award. What is this film about?
Silver Lining Playbook, to my mind, is number one right now on at the top of the Oscar contenders list.
Wow, that's kind of
all
a bold
the films that I've seen, followed by Argo and the other films we've discussed. And the reason, and that win in Toronto is not insignificant. Slumdog Millionaire won that prize, the Audience Award. That means that of all the 300 movies or something that were playing there, that's the one that the audience liked the best. And I just cannot get, it's a great romantic relationship movie starring Bradley Cooper, better than he's ever been, Jennifer Lawrence, better than she's ever been, and David O. Russell almost channels Billy Wilder in the way that this is an unsentimental, unflinching, tough look at these sort of emotionally damaged, and in his case, he's bipolar. He's coming out of a mental institution. These characters are lost, and they somehow find each other and help each other and heal each other, and the families behind them as well. And Robert De Niro as the father is better than we've seen him in a long time. And you're actually rooting for these two to do well with each other and to win a dance contest, believe it or not. And at the end of this movie, the audience in Toronto stood up and cheered. And Jennifer Lawrence has a scene in the movie that is a total crowd pleaser that also got applause.
And Moonrise Kingdom looks like it's taking over the Woody Allen slot. Wes Anderson is now that sort of filmmaker that gets knowledge every year.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, that movie's hanging in there. It's one of the most popular movies of the year, probably the top independent grossing movie. It hung in there like Midnight in Paris did for months and months and months. So that's definitely going to be a contender. I don't know which actors will get nominated, though. I mean, that's a question. Remember, the acting branch is the biggest branch of the Academy. So that has a lot. I mean, it could be popular with them. But like, I don't see Ben Affleck getting nominated, for example, for Argo either. Even if someone like Alan Arkin could get a supporting nod.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think Ben Affleck, maybe not as an actor, but he also directed the film?
He could get nominated as director. And in fact, the fact that he's an actor makes him all the more likely to get nominated because he's popular.
Yes. I mean, I guess a lot of people who have seen the film, maybe yourself included, are saying, look, this is he's proven that he can direct in films like The Town. And now this is kind of not a breakout necessarily, but really
it'll be a bigger hit. It'll be a bigger hit than the others he's done.
Well, and Cloud Atlas is a film that it has a number of directors. I hear the press conference in Toronto was kind of interesting since there were so many people on the dais there. But it was, I guess, critically disappointing.
Yeah, that's a divisive movie. That's a movie where some people sort of say, oh, the book was so much better, so much more intelligent, and this is just a simplified, crazy, you know, accessible version of that book. And then there are other people who didn't read the book who really liked the movie. And I am in that category. I loved Cloud Atlas. And I thought it was great, fun.
I love the book.
It's six stories, as you know, and they are interwoven very cleverly, and you root for each one of them. You're happy to go back. You know, the characters are fun. You're happy to go back to each of the stories, even though some of them are better than others. Jim Broadbent, to my mind, is the person that could come out of it with a nomination, if anybody could. It's gorgeous. It's just beautifully made, and the cinematography and production design. And there's a future story. Two of them are set in the future, and they're just gorgeously imagined. And these people really know what they're doing, and it's fun. I think it's commercial.
Well, I bet that I hope you read the book, by the way, because it is a terrific novel.
I've actually hauled it out. I had it. I read the first book. I read the first section of it, the one with the guy on the boat in the past. And I will go back and finish it now.
But I'm going to guess that this on your temporary list earlier, this movie was probably under the contender section, and that it has dropped down to a long shot. Because
you are correct, white man.
Yes.
Well, and the people associated with the film, directing it, is Tom Tykwer and the Wachowski siblings. And, you know, there's a few people who you might recognize, like Tom Hanks, Hugo Weaving, Susan Sarandon, Hugh Grant,
Halle Berry.
Yeah, just a few people that...
Sturgis.
Yeah. Just so I guess there was a lot of anticipation for this film, and once it screened, people were like, eh.
I don't know. And it's actually more polarizing than that. I would say some people really loved it. And so, I mean, what you get a lot of in Toronto are the critics talking about these things. And Cloud Atlas may not be a critic's picture, but I think it's going to do very well, actually. It's unfortunately very expensive. So that's a question mark for Warner Brothers.
Well, something I did want to mention, not that we are a gossip podcast, but as far as the business is concerned, somebody made their first appearance there after a little bit of a scandal, and that was Kristen Stewart. And I guess a lot was made of the fact that she appeared on the red carpet and was doing interviews, and you know, she was talking to the press, who has not been very kind to her. At least certain portions of the press have not been very kind.
Tabloidy.
Yes.
Tabloidy portions.
Yes.
This is not a tabloid universe. This is a film festival. So they took On the Road, which debuted in Cannes, you know, more seriously. It's 15 minutes shorter. I saw the first version. I haven't seen the second yet, but I'm curious to see it. I will argue that she's the best thing in the movie. So, you know, shoot me.
I guess what you're saying is, you know, she was kind of left alone by the press and by the fans, and you know, it was more of a highbrow event rather than...
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know, actually.
One of the more fascinating movies in your long shot section is The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, which, of course, is part of a trilogy now rather than two films. And we all know that all three of the Lord of the Rings movies were nominated for Best Picture, along with a string of nominations. And then it triumphed, of course, with Part 3. It's funny, if you have a director whose last three movies were all nominated for Best Picture and he just won, you might think, well, gee, surely given that it's the same thing, he's right up there to have another shot at getting a Best Picture. But there's a sense, I guess, before seeing the film that, well, he's already had his time. He was already on the dais. They honored the films. Now he's just going back and doing a prequel. But if the movie comes out and is as magical as the other three, imagine all bets are off and it could be right back in there as a contender.
Nothing more for me to say.
Is there a question in there, sir?
I mean,
obviously that's all true. And I would say, yeah, there's a factor of been there, done that, but he can either rise above that and deliver or not. And my guess is that it will reach the audience. Whether it reaches the Academy is another matter.
That's a very good guess.
Well, now you have here in your long shots, The Dark Knight Rises as a possible long shot for Best Picture. Now, The Dark Knight was one of the films that didn't get nominated for Best Picture when it was released in 2008, and many say helped spur the Academy on to include potentially five additional films in the Best Picture category. But you still think it's a long shot?
Oh, definitely. It's a sequel. It's a franchise. It's a comic book movie. I just don't see the Academy doing more than they've done in the past, which is to reward all of its well-deserved technical achievements.
Well, from Telluride, which is a very kind of quaint film festival, since it's there in a mountain town, to Toronto, that's kind of a huge adjustment, a big shift there to a metropolitan film festival. Has Toronto changed much over the years, especially now that they have their new venue, the Bell Lightbox?
Well, it's great that they've moved downtown, although there's a certain schizophrenia involved in running back and forth to Yorkville for interviews and so on. But it's as big and sprawling. I mean, there was an article that Eric Cohn did in IndieWire sort of questioning Toronto's, you know, vast, you know, sprawl. But that's who they are. That's what they've always done. It's no different than it has ever been. They are big, and that's their identity.
And if there's one big takeaway from Telluride in Toronto this year, what would you say it is?
Well, I would say that we are alive and well. I mean, there's vital blood. There's good nourishment. There's still reasons to believe that on both the studio and the independent side, there's plenty of good stuff coming up. And it doesn't have to be big budget to be good. So the list of movies, and by the way, even though I'm an Oscar prognosticator and I'm someone who totally lives and breathes Oscars, as you know, I actually wish that more people were able to write about these festivals without using the Oscar prism. It gets tiring after a while to see headline after headline after headline after headline. Oh, who's, what's good? And they're all saying the same thing. I know I'm guilty as charged, but, you know, I saw Barbara, a wonderful film from Germany that's going to be the German submission. I saw Pieta, which is happens to be the Korean submission. The Sarah Polley documentary Stories We Tell, a great movie. Looper, not in the Oscar race. Great, great movie. You know, What Maisie Knew, not in the Oscar race. Terrific movie from Siegel and McGeehee, you know, that Millennium picked up. There's so many things to write about and celebrate without having to think about the awards race. And
I really want to see the Sarah Polley documentary. That's gotten terrific reviews. But of all the movies you haven't seen yet, Oscars be damned, just the movies coming out the rest of the year, what's the one you're just chomping at the bit to see? Is it Lincoln or Life of Pi or Les Mis? What would it be?
All of the above. But I have to say Life of Pi. And I'm also curious to see Flight, which is the closing night film in New York. New York has a very strong lineup on paper. They have these three world premieres, including Not Fade Away, the first film by David Chase, set in New Jersey, sort of like an Asbury Park kind of band, you know, kind of a Bruce Springsteen-y feel. I really want to see that too. But Life of Pi was so gorgeous and so beautiful, and Ang Lee is someone I truly admire. I want to see that very much.
Well, certainly, Anne, it's kind of understandable that you write about these festivals with the prism of Oscar in front of you, because, of course, you do a weekly, at least during the award season, a weekly podcast called Oscar Talk, which can be found, I know, on iTunes, but where else can it be found?
Well, In Contention, Chris and I both post it on our sites, so he's got it up on In Contention, and I've got it up on every Friday, usually, on Thompson on Hollywood, but it's also up on iTunes.
Okay, and of course, you can be found on Twitter At AK Stanwyck is your username, and we'll place a link to your Twitter account in the show notes. And of course, to all of your work on Thompson on Hollywood over at IndieWire. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Ann. Well, it was nice of Ann Thompson to stop by. I'm excited to see a lot of those films. I'm going to the New York Film Festival because I haven't been to Toronto. I haven't been to Cannes or Telluride. And that festival is sort of a best of the best festival where they do have some big world premieres, but they also pluck the best movies from a lot of the other festivals. So it's a great chance to catch up in one easy space on, you know, all these terrific movies that are going to be contenders come the end of the year.
Yes, you know, that is true. That is what the New York Film Festival is known for. But I think you're becoming known for something else, because I got a little, my head got a little lost toward the end there with Anne, because you once again said chomp at the bit rather than champs at the bit, which our listener Bill Holton chastised us for
I'm trying.
Okay. Well, Bill, you know, I'd like to apologize for Michael's chomping rather than champing at the bit.
Is it a big deal that I messed that pronunciation up again?
Well, I think given that Bill mentioned it, you know, I would like to say yes, it is a big deal that you mispronounced it or misspoke it. But I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to move us along to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Katie Couric, who made a huge splash in daytime television. The former anchor of NBC's Today launched her talk show last week and scored the biggest debut since Dr. Phil nearly a decade ago. Steve Harvey and a revamped Anderson Cooper also did well, but the queen of daytime is still Ellen DeGeneres. Her season premiere was the highest of her career and grew about 25% over her season premiere in 2011. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's all a big deal. You know, it's a success story. That's why people were waiting for Katie Couric. They knew she would be she brought a lot of love from her days on the Today Show. So we knew that she would be a draw, and that's what she's proven. However, you look at the numbers, and she's pulling like a 2.5 or a 2.7 or a 2.3. This is a far cry from the days of Oprah when she dominated the landscape and was getting a 7 and an 8 and a 9 rating. So yes, daytime talk, you can still be very successful, make a lot of money, but we're, you know, nowhere near where we were 20 years ago.
Well, and it's, you know, her first week, so maybe she will increase over time.
Right, but even the most successful of them today are at a 3 rating.
Oh, you know, I see.
They're not anywhere near what they were, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
Well, let's talk about another woman, Amanda Palmer. You know, first, musician Palmer got fans to pay for the recording of her new album by launching a Kickstarter campaign that raised $1.2 million.
We should do a Kickstarter campaign.
I tell you. You know, called Theater of Evil, the album came out this past week. Now that fans have paid for the album to be made, Palmer wants fans to come on stage and perform the songs on tour. Palmer invited fans who can play a stringed instrument or a saxophone or brass to join her on stage and share in the fun during all of her upcoming tour dates. And she'll provide beer, hugs, high fives, and free merchandise in exchange, or as it's known, by the way, in the business, merch. Now, she's doing this she's giving all this away in exchange for their time and efforts, of course. Some professional musicians, including a union local in Seattle, are denouncing the stunt and say Palmer should be paying her band, not recruiting free talent in each city. Palmer retorts that the extra musicians would cost $35,000 and is not realistic. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. She raised a lot of money on Kickstarter, and some people say, well, if you raised $1.2 million, you should have plenty of money left over to pay $35,000 to have some musicians come on stage. She does have a band with her that is touring. They are making money. They are being paid. She's not trying to do everything on the cheap here. I think the question is whether you feel like she's doing something to save bucks, or whether she thought it was a fun collaborative effort to invite people to come on stage and augment her touring band. I tend to think towards the latter. That's how I took it. That's how she intended it, I imagine, not as a way to get around having to hire a string quartet.
Well, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, invite all these people up on stage and they're going to have their friends and family show up. So it helps sell a few more tickets. And, you know, she made the album a kind of a social experience. She was trying to make the tour the same thing.
Perhaps. I mean, bands have been doing this a long time. I know Fleetwood Mac back in the old days would bring local high school marching bands onto stage to perform Tusk. And I saw on a documentary film about Mumford and Sons, they did the same thing. They had a local high school marching band come on and perform on one of their big songs. So it's not a new stunt. You know, it's something that's been done before. It's just, you know, obviously you don't want to try and do it on the cheap.
Americans are watching more TV, Michael, and they're watching less TV. Wait.
Huh?
Yeah, they're watching more TV and they're watching less TV. I think that kind of balances each other, you know, crosses each other out. But really, it's simple. People are watching more programming than ever, but thanks to tablets and laptops and cell phones, they're actually watching slightly less television on their actual televisions and watching more of it on digital devices. Game consoles are an increasingly important hub, perhaps the unifying quote-unquote box that manufacturers have always been looking for since people can play games, stream videos, and go online with their PS3, Xbox 360s, their Wiis. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's not a surprise to anyone that there are changing patterns of how people consume television. You know, thanks to Hulu and all the other online services like Netflix, they're watching TV shows entire seasons in a weekend. They're watching them on their tablet, and they like to watch it while they're in their car or, you know, on the subway in other ways. So it's not a surprise that they, with more opportunities and more ways to watch TV, more ways to catch up, why wouldn't they? You know, it just would be a surprise if it wasn't happening.
The Kennedy Center Honors announced its latest lineup of artists to receive its honor during an annual televised event. Well, they didn't announce it during an annual televised event, but the honors will be given during an annual televised event. This year, they will highlight the artistic contributions of Oscar-winning actor Dustin Hoffman, Grammy winners and Rock and Roll Hall of Famers Buddy Guy and Led Zeppelin, prima ballerina Natalia Makarova. I hope I pronounced that right.
And make it sound Russian.
I should make it sound Russian?
Yes.
Well, I don't know if I can do that. Also, rounding out that list, TV talk show host David Letterman. Big deal or big whoop?
Which one of these does not fit? I love Letterman, but he just somehow feels out of place next to Led Zeppelin, a prima ballerina, and Dustin Hoffman. But of course, he's a legendary television fixture. It's a big deal for the people involved. It's a fine list. It's a little surprised to find theatrical director Robert Wilson has never received some of our nation's highest honors. I'm not quite sure why. He's gotten a Guggenheim, but I kind of thought he would have received this by now. Maybe somebody should let the Obama administration know that they need to add someone on for next year's list.
You know, I've actually seen some of Robert Wilson's operas, not to get off on a tangent here during our lightning round, but I've seen a couple of his operas, actually like three or four of them. And they are, you know, opera's supposed to be this dramatic, presentation of music and story. And his whole MO as a theatrical director of operas is to make everything so kind of static and very minimalistic. And I saw like a 5.5 hour Wagner opera. You want to talk about a long, long theatrical experience. That was definitely one of the longest, even with Placido Domingo. It was a long opera.
Philistine.
Hey, Michael, do you remember just 2 weeks ago when we said that a biography of controversial football coach Joe Paterno had debuted at number one on the nonfiction bestseller charts?
I do.
Well, because publishers are now releasing actual sales figures, we know that that book sold 11,439 copies. Not 11,440 copies, but 11,439 copies, which we rightly pointed out was kind of a very modest total. So instead of saying it had debuted at number one and was a hit, we knew, in fact, the Paterno book stirred very little interest at all. Now, here's the proof. There's another new number one nonfiction title. In fact, it's the number one best-selling book of the week, period, toppling 50 Shades of Grey, which means it has to be better than, you know, pseudo-sex or fictional kind of erotica. It's that news-making memoir by a Navy SEAL. He talks about his career in the SEALs and the killing of Osama bin Laden. It sold, get this, Michael, 253,000 copies in its first week. Now that's a bestseller. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal that we can tell what books are selling. It makes a big difference to say your movie opened at number one with $100 million, opened at number one in a slow week with $8 million. And charting it week to week and seeing what kind of legs it has, it's going to really revolutionize book selling and how people treat the charts and the impact that it has when a book has big numbers. It's really going to, you know, get people to try new books that they wouldn't otherwise, experiment. It's a great thing overall.
Sons of Anarchy, the FX drama about a biker gang, otherwise known as My Memoirs, had a record high with its season opener last week. The acclaimed drama reached 5.3 million viewers for its fifth season premiere and 7.5 million when you include the two encores, which aired later that night. Presumably, the total will be even higher, of course, Michael, as you know, when you start adding in all those DVR viewings. Best of all, it was the number one show for the night in men aged 18 to 49. Sons of Anarchy has never received much Emmy love, just as they ignored Buffy the Vampire Slayer simply because it was about a high school girl fighting monsters. They ignore this show because it's about a biker gang. And I take personal offense to that, given that this is, as I mentioned, my memoir. And yet, 5 seasons in, the show is bigger than ever. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. One, you almost never used to see shows grow in their audience year after year, 5 seasons into a run. Law and Order once made headlines because it went into reruns, and then that boosted the new episodes that were airing on NBC. And so 5, 6, 7 years into its run, you saw it growing in its audience. And that was sort of mind-blowing. Nowadays, shows keep, Mad Men keeps growing. Games of Thrones will probably be growing 3, 4, 5 years into its run. Walking Dead will probably keep growing. Shows that you can catch up on. You know, what excuse do you have for not watching Sons of Anarchy? Even if you haven't watched it for its first 4 years, it's got great reviews. Critics love it. It's a lot of fun. And it's available on Netflix. It's available on DVD. You have no excuse. Anyone who doesn't watch this show is an idiot.
Well, unless like me, you've lived it. In which case,
Like me, where I'm an idiot and I have all 5 seasons sitting there on my shelf waiting to watch. I can't wait to start watching it, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. So I understand there's a lot of television around. It's hard to catch up, but it's great that you have the chance now and that you don't have to wait. You can start recording the new season on your DVR, catch up on the DVDs of the past seasons, and be right up where with everybody else.
Well, here's another way to catch up on some television, at least in certain parts of the world. As you know, Michael, TV fans looking to cut the cord have longed for HBO to offer its streaming and online service HBO Go as a standalone service, one you could purchase, say, without subscribing to cable. Well, guess what? It's finally happening.
Yay!
Unfortunately, you may have to move to Sweden, Norway, Finland, or Denmark to get it. News reports have HBO, they say HBO is about ready to launch its TV library on demand in Scandinavia. Interestingly, it may use Spotify, the music streaming service, to do it. Spotify is hugely dominant in those countries, where almost all revenue for record labels comes from the subscription streaming service. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I guess it's a big deal. If HBO does it there and can see how it impacts, you know, the rates of subscribers who actually pay to watch the shows on cable or via satellite, there's no reason why, if it doesn't work and make sense for them financially, they wouldn't ultimately expand it around the world.
Well, you know, recently, you know, HBO Nordic announced that they would be launching in mid-October and they would be offering their channel or their programming on cable networks and cable to cable providers. And now they're also offering it kind of as a standalone service, this HBO Go service. So I think that's really the big thing here. You know, they really can't do that in the States because it would just undermine the subscription service. At least that's what HBO has been saying.
Well, and that's what the cable people say. That's why they pay HBO a lot of money and everybody gets a lot of money to have them on there, because that's how it works. That's the model that we've created. But why doesn't it upend the system that's in place overseas?
Because it's not in place yet. So effectively, they're saying, look, we'll take subscribers any way we can get them. We'll do it through cable. We'll do it through standalone HBO Go subscriptions.
You mean HBO simply wasn't available there?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh, I see. So if they were starting from scratch in the U.S., I imagine they might have made it available as a standalone offering. Why not? If you've got a cable channel, why would you limit yourselves to people who have cable subscriptions if you're brand new? You know, why not say, hey, you can just access us via our website?
Yeah, and the whole Spotify stuff is, you know, kind of rumor and conjecture, and nobody really knows for sure whether that's true. Although ever since Spotify started in Sweden, so that's its home territory, you know, everybody said, well, you're doing this with music. You're probably going to do this with television and movies as well. And I think that's more kind of wishful thinking than anything else.
Well, it's sort of like what Netflix does, right?
Yes, exactly. And okay. Of course, Netflix has announced that they are launching their own competition to whatever HBO is offering in Scandinavia.
All right.
But, you know, all of this streaming media may be bad for the environment. I mean, did you think that getting rid of all those compact discs and DVDs and going digital would benefit the environment, Michael?
Maybe.
Well, you should think again. According to a new study, streaming music and movies over and over again could, in fact, suck up more electricity than printing up a compact disc and shipping it to your home. Listening to an album just 27 times via streaming, mind you, 27 times without compression, would equal the environmental impact of one compact disc. More to the point, overall demand for streaming is huge. YouTube accounted for 0.1% of global energy consumption all on its own. That's expected to rise to 1% in 2013. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. The first part sort of lost me. Well, if I stream it 27 times, it's like buying an album. Well, most people probably won't listen to most albums 27 times, especially when they're looking at a subscription service. But I guess 27 plays of any album is equal to buying a single compact disc. And you have to work out, well, how many albums would you normally buy a month or versus how many are you streaming? I don't know about that. But when you put it down to the simple fact that streaming creates a lot of demand for electricity and that YouTube alone could be 1% of the entire world's electrical consumption needs in 2013, well, that's kind of mind-blowing if you think about it. One specific website is 1% of the entire global energy demands for electricity. Wow. So clearly, it's having a big environmental impact because it's creating a demand for bandwidth and electricity.
Yeah, I mean, the author of this particular study says unlicensed file sharing could consume the equivalent of up to four times the annual combined electricity consumption of all UK households.
What is unlicensed file consumption? You mean stealing?
Yeah, pirating. Piracy, you know,
so,
like BitTorrent.
So he's just estimating the idea that since it is available to steal, people are using a lot more bandwidth than they would have if you had to pay for it.
Yeah, and to me, what kind of undermines this study a bit is the fact that they're saying without compression. Well, nobody's streaming anything without compression that I know of.
Right. So I think a lot of the details are murky on this, but the overall fact that online streaming is driving electrical demand makes sense.
Yes, I do like the idea that they could actually give you a disk drive with every piece of music ever recorded put on it, and then it's not playable unless you subscribe to a service and unlock it. I think that's kind of interesting. I don't know how many people would actually go for that, and certainly the industry would kind of, you know, have a little bit of a heart palpitation.
Well, that was a workaround, an idea of what can you do to counter this demand, this growing demand for streaming. And one idea was to just give them all the music right away and give them a key to unlock it in their homes. Then they don't have to keep streaming it.
Right, exactly. American Idol has found its voice. Oh, I see what you did there. American Idol and voice. Okay, I get it. Yes, after several years of increasing competition from the likes of The X Factor and The Voice, American Idol shook up the judges panel yet again. Joining Mariah Carey are rapper Nicki Minaj and country artist Keith Urban. Despite an earlier decision to turn Randy Jackson into a mentor, he is remaining as a judge, with Jimmy Iovine staying in the mentor role. That makes Idol look a lot like the judges panel on The Voice, with its combo of country, R&B, rock, and diva Christina Aguilera. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's the number two show in the country. They were clearly shaken up after losing Jennifer Lopez and Mr. Aerosmith Steven Tyler. Who knows how good these people will be? Mariah Carey is a big name. It doesn't mean she's going to be a good judge. Nicki Minaj, it's kind of an odd choice in my mind because she's such a young artist that I'm not quite sure how she benefits. Keith Urban, again, nice guy, major country artist figure. It all depends on how willing they are to be critique, to be smart, to be savvy, to be good on camera, to deliver one-liners, to actually be blunt with kids and people who are on stage performing, and their chemistry with each other. So they're all big names. They all bring a certain credibility. It all depends how they play off each other. The people on The Voice play off each other very, very well, I have to say. So, you know, Idol's got a lot of its work cut out for it.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I guess what you're saying is that some of these new judges have to be able to say, "You suck."
That's right. Of course, Simon Cowell's the best at that. And The X Factor just had its season debut, and it was down from last season.
Yeah, I was going to say, it had its season debut, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. And it was down in its ratings from last season, which were themselves considered a little bit lower than Simon Cowell had been predicting and tub-thumping for the series. However, it's facing off against The Voice, and you know there's a lot of competition for reality singing television right now. It's going to still hopefully make money, I imagine. It's got a good group of people. I've already heard a lot of good talent on that show in those first few episodes. And you have to look at The X Factor UK is still doing well. It jumped up its second week in the ratings. It had debuted a little bit lower and made news for that. But now it's pulled back up higher again.
But how many other singing shows are there in the UK competing?
There aren't nearly as many.
Okay.
For some reason, Idol never capitalized on its. It got so focused on America and expanding around the world that it really dropped the ball, and that's what left the door open for The X Factor. So there aren't as many singing competitions, I don't think, in UK. They obviously have the UK Got Talent, which has a lot of you know, performances, but singing tends to dominate, as it does everywhere.
Right.
So, you know, I think they've probably got a fair amount of glut like us, but not quite as many as we have right now in North America.
And how were Britney Spears and Demi Lovato as judges on X Factor?
I liked it. I thought they also had good chemistry with Simon and L.A. Reid. Demi basically is playing the little ingenue. Every time there's cute guys on stage, she's like, "You're really cute." And Simon's like, "Behave, behave," like he's her uncle or something. Britney is more the wizened veteran who sort of gets, you know, wary of people who are freaks and weird. And they're being fairly blunt. So it'll take time to see how good they are critiquing. But they've had a good start.
Wait, Britney Spears is, you know, kind of against people who are freaks and weird? That's interesting. Okay. It's like the pot calling the kettle black there.
Okay.
Well, okay. Well, let's move on before I get myself into more trouble with the Britney Spears fans. Oh, I see fire and I see rain. And I see a whole lot of... Was I supposed to sing that, by the way?
I hope not.
Okay. You know, besides fire and rain, I see a whole lot of lawyers. Yes, singer-songwriter James Taylor is suing his old record label, Warner Brothers. It's all over our age-old friend, royalty rates. And we've talked about this thousands of times on this show. Taylor got the right to audit Warner Brothers a few years ago and found all sorts of oddities. But the biggest argument of all, one involving millions of dollars, is over royalty rates for digital downloads. Taylor says he gets 50% of all licensing fees, and since Warner Brothers loudly and regularly tells consumers they have only licensed the music, not purchased it, he wants his cut. Warner Brothers says, subtract the two, no. When it comes to accounting, that in fact, the MP3 album was a sale after all, and he gets only, after tax, 10%. They're headed to court over it, of course. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. This is fascinating. Everybody is suing over this. It keeps happening again and again. The labels have really boxed themselves into a corner, and Hollywood better pay attention. Essentially, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to tell consumers, you don't own the album. You can't give it to anyone else. You can't sell it to anyone else. You can't even will it to your children. So Bruce Willis says, I spent $100,000 on music, and you're telling me I can't give it to my kids when I die, that I lose all that? And they say, yup. The problem is, if they are only licensing it, then the artists get this much higher royalty rate, because licensing typically was money made when you licensed a song to be used on a movie or a TV show or in an ad or something like that. So they can't have it both ways. They can't say it's a sale when it gets them a better money rate, and they can't say it's licensing when it gets them more rights than they had otherwise. They're killing themselves on both ends. It's really a big problem. They can't get away with it. It's going to go to court. And I think the labels ultimately will have to be taken to court over their claim that it's not a, you know, it's not a licensing. You know, they don't realize that it's to their benefit ultimately when they lose in court and are told, no, no, no. When someone bought that James Taylor album, they bought it. You claimed that it was just licensing it, but it's not true.
Which will be very good for the musicians, of course, because then it really will be 10% for James Taylor and not 50% of a licensing fee.
But that's okay. That's what he would get if the album was sold.
Good point. Yeah.
You know, that's the royalty rate he got for a sale. And it is a sale. And ultimately, the artist will have the right royalty rate for what happens, which is a sale. And I think it's ultimately going to be the way it goes. It has to be. It only makes sense that way. But it has to go through the courts first.
Glenn Beck is coming back to TV. Dish TV. Boo. No, I don't. Somebody had to counterbalance you, I guess.
No, it gives Jon Stewart something to make fun of.
That's true. Glenn Beck left Fox News in June of 2011, giving Jon Stewart nothing to make fun of. And he headed to the brave new world of the internet, where he launched Glenn Beck University, because everybody wants a degree from Glenn Beck University. He produced dozens of hours of content each week, signed up 300,000 subscribers who were ready to pay $10 a month or $100 a year for Blaze TV, and pulled in anywhere from $30 million to $40 million since then. So I guess he's technically laughing last. But now he's returning to TV anyway, with Dish deciding to sign up Beck's TV programming, including a kids show, a live broadcast of his radio show, and Beck's signature analysis of the day's events for Dish, the satellite network. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. He did succeed on the internet, but it proves how great it is to have a platform. Even though he established his name and was able to transfer that to the internet and build his own business and do very well with it, he still sees the value in a wider, bigger, larger audience that Dish TV can provide to him.
Well, think about it this way. I mean, 300,000 people, yeah, that's great that they're all paying him and the money's going directly to him. But at the end of the day, your influence is 300,000 people strong, not 4 million people strong.
That's right. You reach a lot of fewer people with your political views. And ultimately, with that smaller core audience, they're fervent admirers, but there aren't 3 or 4 million people who might say, yeah, I think I'll buy the new Glenn Beck book.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's sort of a nice thumbing of the nose to Fox, because, I mean, when he left, they were happy to see him go, despite his good ratings. And I think Rupert Murdoch said something like, well, some people say he quit. Some people say he was fired. We're happy with either version.
Well, you know what? That is actually a fantastic segue into this week's Inside Baseball story. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And guess what, Michael? This week is about Fox, in this case, 20th Century Fox, firing somebody, or did this person quit and leave out of their own accord?
Well, I mean, the official word is that he decided to step down after 18 years. It's Tom Rothman, the head of the film studio. And his press release, his letter that he sent out to people said, hey, he's had a great 18-year run. He's been the head of Fox longer than anyone since Daryl Zanuck himself. He's had a string of great hits and profitable years, including the two biggest hits of all time. They've got a really great slate coming up, and he wants to look for new challenges. You know, he's been doing this for a long time now. And so, hey, you know, he's sorry to go, but this is the time to do it, and he's had a great run. That's his version of events.
Right, but, you know, according to, well, press reports and several outsiders, you know, they say, look, Fox's summer slate was not that great. You had Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, Prometheus, which was the prequel to Alien. That didn't do too well. The Watch, which was originally called Neighborhood Watch. That's the Ben Stiller film, which tanked.
But he's been there for 18 years.
He's been there for 18.
Summer slate would not bring you down.
I completely agree. I mean, the guy's had one of the more successful runs as a studio head. He also, of course, turned down Ted from Seth MacFarlane. And Seth MacFarlane has a little show over on the Fox network called The Family Guy. So I guess Mr. Seth MacFarlane was not that happy.
I guess, why would you not want to do the synergy of that? You didn't think you deserved to make a feature film? It was like $65 million. I guess it was in that middle range where you feel uncomfortable because it's not low budget and it's not a big blockbuster. So it's sort of in that weird range that Hollywood has been wary of. They sort of are scared of trying to get a double. You know, they don't mind going for a home run. They don't mind a $5 million indie film, but they're scared of those movies that cost $50 to $80 million because they just feel like they're going to slip through the cracks. But obviously, Seth MacFarlane is such a valuable property to Fox. Why you wouldn't want to have that synergy and give him a shot at his first feature film is beyond me.
Yeah, I don't know either. But, you know, he did actually, he is notably behind Night at the Museum and Alvin and the Chipmunks and the Ice Age sequels or franchises. So I guess,
But didn't, was on his watch, they made Titanic.
Well, yes, they made Titanic and they made Avatar, although it is publicly known, I guess, by many, or maybe not publicly, but at least within the industry, that he opposed both of those films. He did not want to make those. And it was Jim Giannopoulos, who he has been heading up Fox with for the past 11 years, who kind of was the champion for those films. And guess who's sticking around?
Who's the new head of Fox Films?
Jim Giannopoulos.
What a coincidence.
Yes, exactly. So, and everybody, you know, Jim Giannopoulos is known throughout the industry as being just a really great guy and, you know, great talent relationships and good to work
with. That's what they say about everybody in Hollywood.
Well,
when they're in power. That's what I laugh. Now that he's out, suddenly there was a news story saying, oh, Tom Rothman was autocratic as a head of Fox. Oh, really? You know, autocratic. I go, yeah, as opposed to all the touchy-feely heads of studios that we've had throughout the past 100 years. Every head of a studio is autocratic.
Yeah, well, and as well, you know, it's a tough job, and, you know, not everybody's going to agree with you. But, you know, he held that job at Fox, 18 years, which is longer than any head since Daryl Zanuck ran the studio.
At Fox. I don't know about any other studio.
Well, sorry, yes, you're right. I meant at Fox. But what I like is the fact that in The Hollywood Reporter, they interviewed Jim Giannopoulos earlier this week, and they said that And I'm quoting here from The Hollywood Reporter that Jim Giannopoulos, who turned 60 in March, has shared the chairman CEO role with Tom Rothman for 11 years, a remarkably stable marriage by studio standards. And 3 days later, he's, no longer sharing that role with Tom Rothman.
Tom could see the writing was on the wall.
I don't necessarily know whether he could see the writing was on the wall, but I know that it was the whole DreamWorks thing, the DreamWorks animation thing, that really started the ball rolling.
Right. He adamantly opposed doing this deal with DreamWorks and DreamWorks Animation and signing them up and having them partners on animation. If you're the co-head of the studio and something you really don't want to happen happens, that's not a good sign. When you're co-head of the studio and you kibosh two of the biggest hits of all time and they get made anyway and prove you, you know, wildly wrong, that doesn't really help.
No, and there was
eventually you have to say, gee, this doesn't look good.
Well, and he's widely considered to be a smart, intelligent studio executive. There were rumors that he was kind of talking to Universal about heading that studio up and that Fox may not have liked that. So they kind of said, look, we're going to, you know, demote you, Tom, and Jim Giannopoulos will take over. There's a whole, you know, restructuring of Fox and the Fox television.
Well, he was losing some of his kingdom.
Right. And so he said, you know what? Actually, I'm going to step down. Those were his two options, take a demotion or step down. And he decided to step down.
And he said that the slate coming up is really great, really strong. Is that true?
Well, I guess what do we have? I know they're releasing Lincoln, right?
Well, they have the international rights to Lincoln. So Universal has the domestic rights. And I say having the international rights to Lincoln is kind of like having the domestic rights to a film about the sport of cricket. It's like, do you really want the international rights to Lincoln? Don't you want at least the North American rights? I'd rather have them all. If I hate splitting up rights between domestic and theatrical. That's what they did with Titanic. You know, they kept domestic and gave away international. I sure as heck bet they wish they hadn't done that.
Yeah, but at the time, remember, that was going down, you know.
I don't care. You're making a movie. I want to own the... If you're making a spectacle, I want to own worldwide rights. Lincoln, if I have to choose, I'm choosing domestic.
Okay, well, I don't necessarily know what else is coming out from Fox, well,
Team. They have Life of Pi.
Okay.
It's an Ang Lee film, Oscar hopeful. I feel iffy about it. They have a comedy with Billy Crystal and Bette Midler. They have The Sessions, that film that Ann Thompson talked about with John Hawkes and Helen Hunt. Probably not a big commercial prospect, but an award season contender, and it could do well, you know, in the indie world sort of way. And they have the new Liam Neeson action film Taken 2. So they've got some movies, but it's not exactly a world-beating collection of, you know, massive hits.
Well, not every year can you have Avatar.
That's right. I bet they wish they had Avatar.
Probably.
So do you think this will, I guess since Jim Giannopoulos has been in charge, this won't really impact Fox that much. He can put his own stamp on it, but it sounds like he's been doing that already.
Yes, indeed. Giannopoulos is always the person, along with Rothman every now and again, to address all the exhibitors at CinemaCon and Show East. So, you know, Giannopoulos is no stranger to this business.
So he's been the face of Fox to distributors?
Well, as along with Rothman, but you mean to movie theater owners. But yeah, I mean, I think more people would know Giannopoulos by sight and by name than Rothman.
Oh, well, there you go.
At least, you know, on the movie theater side. That's just...
And people who know us by sight and name should send us an email and let us know how much they enjoy it.
Indeed, you could send that email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You know, you can also call us and tell us how much you love us. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or Stitcher or through an RSS reader, or you can, you know, sign up for our weekly email. When we post a new episode, we'll send you an email. And of course, you can rate and review the show on any of those podcast aggregators. We really urge you to do that. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, those ways to email us or call us, and also ways to follow us or like us. You can follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is showbizsandbox, and on Facebook, our page is at showbizsandbox. Go figure. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website where some of his work can be found. It is,
astonishingly enough, michaelgiltz.com.
I'd like to thank Ann Thompson for joining us today. Her work can be found on IndieWire. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.